Hello, this is Tamara with the Decatur Herald and Review. It's Wednesday, March 25th. Let's start today's reading on the front page. We have some great pictures today. From photographer Joe Ressler, we have boys from the Mount Zion 9U baseball team on Monday, March 23rd. We have Axel Martin sliding into home during a practice game. And we have Parker Robb throwing the ball to first during a practice game with the Mount Zion 9U baseball team. In our last photo is of Jaden Patterson diving back to first base during a practice game. Now from Valerie Wells in Decatur, Jacardia Wright returning to hometown. Super Bowl champion to appear at Lincoln Square Theater. Decatur's own Super Bowl champion, Jacardia Wright, will come to the Lincoln Square Theater for an appearance at 7 p.m. Friday, July 10th. After days of teasing a big announcement, the Lincoln held a news conference on Tuesday to reveal the surprise. Tickets go on sale noon Wednesday, and Mark Scranton, vice president, the theater's board, said tickets will be available in blocks and priced with young people in mind. Kids need inspiration, they need a leader, and they need a hero, Scranton said. Wright, a graduate of St. Teresa High School, plays running back for the Seattle Seahawks, signed as an undrafted free agent in 2025. The Seahawks bested the New England Patriots in Super Bowl LX 29-13. Tammy Corwin, director of marketing for the Lincoln, said Wright's message will be, "Life is coming to tackle you," and he will talk about his childhood growing up in Decatur, his dreams of playing pro football, and the people who helped him make that dream come true. "The hope," Scranton said, "is that the young people of Decatur will be inspired to dream big, the way Scranton and Lavelle Hunt did when they undertook the restoration of the historic Lincoln. When they took over the theater, which was built in 1916, it had been closed and deteriorating for years. Its glory days when it hosted such luminaries as Harry Houdini, Ethel Barrymore, and Bob Hope were long past, and even its later life as a movie theater was over. The two men and an army of volunteers and donors restored the venue, and it reopened in 22, with concerts, live performances, and community events filling the calendar ever since. Bringing Wright home to speak to his neighbors, friends, and supporters in his hometown, who helped him realize his own big dreams, is exciting," Scranton said. "Today is more than an announcement," said Mirinda Rothrock, president of the Decatur Regional Chamber of Commerce. "It shows the pride that we have for those in our community who have gone on to achieve at the highest level." From Olivia Jacobs, Pantograph, local and state news. The chicks to headline Illinois State Fair. Springfield. The Chicks will headline the Illinois State Fair grandstand stage on Saturday, August 22nd. The band, known for powerhouse vocals and an award-winning catalog, have earned recognition as the biggest-selling U.S. female band of all time, selling more than 30.5 million albums, according to a news release from fair organizers. The Chicks are the only female group to achieve multiple diamond-selling releases, which means they've sold more than 10 million copies. The trio, including Natalie Maines, Marty McGuire, and Emily Strayer, have earned 13 Grammy Awards, 6 Billboard Music Awards, 4 American Music Awards, and several Country Music Association Awards. "We're proud to continue bringing top-tier entertainment to the Illinois State Fair, and the Chicks are a fantastic addition to this year's lineup," said Jerry Costello II, Illinois Department of Agriculture, in a news release. "Their music has stood the test of time and continues to resonate with fans of all ages. We're excited to welcome them to Springfield this August. They found success with their debut album, Wide Open Spaces, and they are known for hits like Cowboy, Take Me Away, and Landslide, and Not Ready to Make Nice." The State Fair organizers said the Chicks are also known for their tight harmonies, masterful musicianship, and powerful live performances. After a nearly 14-year hiatus, the Chicks released their fifth studio album, Gaslighter, in July 2020 with Columbia Records. The 12-track record was co-produced by Jack Antonoff, an award-winning songwriter and producer. The album has been said to be the band's most progressive and original work to date, reaffirming their places as one of the most influential groups in music. The Chicks are known for putting on an unforgettable show, said Rebecca Clark, fair manager, in the news release. With a catalog of songs that so many people know and love, this will be a special night at the Grandstand that fairgoers won't want to miss. Tickets go on sale at 10 a.m. Saturday, March 28th via Ticketmaster. Tickets range from $88 to $168. A $30 pre-show party ticket is also available as an upgrade for all paid concerts. The Illinois State Fair runs August 13th through 23rd at the fairgrounds in Springfield. Other acts announced so far include Bailey Zimmerman on August 14th, Lainey Wilson on August 15th, Matchbox 20 on August 16th, Ella Langley on August 21st, and Shine Down on August 23rd. From Scott Perry in Decatur, DMH schools set up for health fair. Decatur Memorial Hospital and Decatur Public Schools are co-sponsoring a Health is a Journey Health and Resource Fair from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, March 26th. The event will be held at Hope Academy, 955 North Illinois Street in Decatur. It will include taste testing and cooking demonstrations for healthy food prep, mental health wellness activities, health resources, home ownership information provided by a local realtor, and a family-style dinner. The food pantry will be available for families to shop as well. We believe good health starts in the community, and events like this are how we demonstrate our commitment, said DMH Community Health Consultant Sonia Sharjagwa. We love partnering with Decatur Public Schools to give students and families access to healthy food, wellness support, and real resources they can use. Special thanks to our local vendors who are supporting the event, too. Giveaways for randomly selected winners will include 2 adult bicycles, 2 children's bicycles, 2 toddler bicycles, and 1 month passes to Decatur Indoor Sports Center and the Decatur Family YMCA. From our food page today, we have Going Retro. Make a cheesy broccoli chicken bake like you remember. From Gretchen McKay in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Most of us who grew up in the 70s and 80s can recall certain staple dishes, either with love or so much distaste. Then, and to this day, I can't stand even the thought of tuna nuda casserole. A meal my older brothers loved. They'd fight over the crunchy crust of the Ritz crackers my mom always piled on top, and my husband, every once in a blue moon, asks for it. But the cheesy mix of chicken and broccoli known as chicken divan, man, I could eat that once a week and never complain. Named after the Divan Parisienne restaurant at Chatham Hotel in New York City, where the dish was created in the early 1900s. Chicken Divan became smart mother's tactic for getting their kids to eat vegetables after the recipe popped up in cookbooks in the late 1950s and early 60s. Broccoli is slightly bitter when raw and mushy and slightly stinky when overcooked, so it can be a hard sell on its own. But add some roasted chicken and top it with a creamy cheese sauce, and the result is a rich and cozy casserole that even the pickiest child will happily eat. There are probably as many recipes for broccoli cheese casserole as there are cooks. Many include canned soup and mayo, my mom's version, and can be made with either fresh or frozen florets. The topping also can be personalized with crackers, breadcrumbs, panko, or just a generous sprinkling of grated Parmesan cheese, or sometimes a combo of all of the above. In this recipe, I went the fresh route with a package of long and tender baby broccoli from Trader Joe's. I also used 2 types of cheese, grated Parmesan and extra sharp cheddar, in the butter-based sauce along with some heavy cream. I had hoped to top the casserole with a crunchy layer of tater tots, very trendy these days, but could only find hash brown patties. So I cut them into squares, fried them in a little butter to crisp them up, and crossed my fingers. It would work. It did, beautifully. For the complete list of ingredients and the recipe directions, see the in-print version of the Herald and Review, page B5. Now our first column from our opinion page. Our topic is How to Win War in Iran. Our first column is from Chuck DeVore, who is a Chief National Initiatives Officer for the Texas Public Policy Foundation, a retired U.S. Army intelligence officer, and a former California State Assemblyman. He wrote this for the Chicago Tribune. Air power can shatter mullahs, trigger uprising. Americans tend to ignore foreign policy. Living in a continent-sized nation bounded by two vast oceans allows for that dangerous self-deception. But when we're attacked, or the price of gas spikes, we're rudely reminded that while we may not care about the world cares for us. Why did President Donald Trump order an attack on Iran? Two reasons. Because we had to, and because we had the ability to achieve victory. The Islamic Republic of Iran has been a problem for the U.S. since President Jimmy Carter encouraged the fall of the Shah in 1979. Carter was worried about human rights. If only he knew the horrors his actions would unleash. The pattern of Iranian aggression began in 1979 when revolutionaries seized the U.S. Embassy in Tehran and held 52 American hostages for 444 days. This act of war humiliated the U.S. and established Tehran's playbook: terrorism, defiance, and impunity. 4 years later, Iran-backed nascent militant group Hezbollah's suicide bombing of the Marine barracks in Beirut, which killed 241 U.S. service members on a peacekeeping mission. Iran's support for deadly proxies includes Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in Gaza, the Houthis in Yemen, and Shia militias in Iraq and Syria. They act as Tehran's forward bases, attacking U.S. forces and allies with funding, weapons, and direction from Iran. During the extended conflict and occupation of Iraq, Iranian-supplied explosive devices killed or wounded hundreds of American troops. Closer to home, Iran conducts illegal operations on U.S. soil, including cyber espionage, assassination plots, and attempts to smuggle agents across our borders. Globally, Iran aids Russia's war on Ukraine by supplying Shahed drones, cheap, deadly kamikaze weapons that mostly kill and maim Ukrainian civilians, while draining Western resources. With China's help, Iran has been rapidly expanding its ballistic missile arsenal. And then there's Iran's nuclear weapons program. Iran has amassed about a ton of highly enriched uranium, material with no credible civilian use. While June's Operation Midnight Hammer interrupted Iranian progress towards a larger nuclear stockpile, its existing stocks of 60% enriched uranium could be quickly processed to weapons grade. Further, Iran's corrupt theocratic regime believes that its actions against the great Satan, America, and the little Satan, Israel, can bring about the apocalyptic arrival of the hidden 12th Imam. Hardly people that traditional nuclear deterrence would be effective against. Why now? The face of warfare has transformed since Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution. What once demanded hundreds of thousands of ground troops can now be accomplished with through precision air power. Advances in guided munitions, drones, and intelligence enable rapid strikes with accuracy measured in mere feet, dismantling missile sites, command centers, and leadership swiftly. Crucially, the Iranian people can serve as the decisive force on the ground. Widespread discontent fueled by repression, economic failure, corruption, and protests over rights and shortages has eroded regime loyalty. Unlike more cohesive dictatorships, Iran's young people, middle class, and ethnic minorities are primed to rise once air power shatters the mullah's control. Further, the clandestine infiltration of Starlink terminals allows unprecedented coordination among dissident groups. Trump's decision to eliminate a growing threat might also achieve lasting strategic results for American national security. The collapse of Iran's Ayatollahs will rank with the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 and the collapse of the Soviet Union 2 years later. Had action been deferred, Iran's rapidly increasing ballistic missile would have soon reached the point of immunity, erecting a shield of threatened destruction behind which the mullah's nuclear program could be rebuilt. Iran has a long and proud history, but the past 47 years under theocratic rule have been an aberration that's held the region and world hostage to violence, chaos, and threats. From David Bowder, Associated Press, New York. Judge orders return of Voice of America. Government has already filed notice to appeal. In a strongly worded decision last week, a federal judge ordered that the Voice of America, its mission to provide news for countries around the world, that was largely shut down for the past year by the Trump administration, come roaring back to life. Whether or not that actually happens is anybody's guess. The government filed notice March 19th to appeal U.S. District Court Judge Royce Lamberth's order 2 days earlier to put hundreds of VOA employees who have been on paid leave the past year back to work. Lamberth had ruled on March 7th that Carrie Lake, who was President Donald Trump's choice to oversee the bureaucratic parent U.S. Agency for Global Media, didn't have the authority to reduce VOA to a skeleton. The Voice of America was established as a news source in World War II, beaming reports to many countries that had no tradition of a free press. Before Trump took office again last year, Voice of America was operating in 49 different languages, heard by an estimated 362 million people. Trump's team contended that government-run news sources, which also include Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, were an example of bloated government and that they wanted news reporting more favorable to the current administration. With a greatly reduced staff, it currently operates in Iran, Afghanistan, China, North Korea, and in countries with a large population of Kurds. Lamberth, in his decision, said Lake had repeatedly thumbed her nose at laws mandating VOA's operation. VOA Director Michael Abramovitz said legislators in both parties understand the need for a strong operation and have set aside enough funding for the job to be done. It is time for all parties to come together and work to rebuild and strengthen the agency, he said. Don't expect that to happen soon. President Trump was elected to eliminate waste, fraud, and abuse across the administration, including the Voice of America, and efforts to improve efficiency at USAGM have been a tremendous success, said White House spokeswoman Anna Kelly. This will not be the final say on the matter. Patsy Wiedrich-Kuswara, VOA's White House bureau chief and a plaintiff in the lawsuit to bring it back, said that restoring the physical infrastructure is going to take a lot of money and some time, but it can be done. What is more difficult is recovering from the trauma that our newsroom has gone through. It's an open question whether the administration wants a real news organization or a mouthpiece, said David Ensor, a former Voice of America director between 2010 and 2014. The administration has made efforts over the past year to bolster friendly outlets and fight coverage that displeases them. Even though Congress has required that Voice of America be an objective and unbiased news source, last week it was announced that Christopher Wallace, an executive at the conservative network Newsmax, who had previously spent 15 years at Fox News Channel, will be the new deputy director at VOA. Abramovitz didn't know he was getting a new deputy until it was announced. Wiedrich-Kuswara wouldn't comment on what Wallace's appointment might mean. I'm not going to pass judgment before seeing his work, she said. While Lamberth ordered more than 1,000 employees on leave to go back to work, it's not clear how many of them moved on to other jobs or retired in the past year. The judge also said he did not have the authority to bring back hundreds of independent contractors who were terminated. One employee he left is Steve Herman, a former White House bureau chief and national correspondent at VOA, and now executive director of the Jordan Center for Journalism, Advocacy, and Innovation at the University of Mississippi. Despite the court decisions, he questions whether the Trump administration would oversee a return to what the organization used to be. I'm a bit of a pessimist, Herman said. I think it's going to be very difficult. Besides fighting to shut it down, Trump is loath to admit defeat. Earlier this month, the White House nominated Sarah Rogers, the Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy, to run the U.S. Agency for Global Media, putting it more firmly within the administration's control. Her nomination requires Senate approval. Is Marco Rubio's State Department going to allow objective journalism in 49 languages, Herman asked? I don't think so. I would want that to happen, but that's a fairy tale. In the budget bill passed in February, Congress set aside $200 million for Voice of America's operation. While that represents about a 25% cut in the agency's previous appropriation, it sent a bipartisan message of support, said Kate Knieper, VOA's Director of Strategy and Performance Evaluation. besides being a plaintiff with Witwatersrand in the lawsuit to restore the agency, she has helped some of her colleagues deal with some of their own problems over the past year, including immigration issues. There is a lot of enthusiasm for going back to work, she said. The hunger for information from Voice of America in Iran when he was director was a clear example of what the organization meant, Ensor said. Surveys showed that between a quarter and a third of Iran's households turned into VOA once a week, primarily on satellite television. Occasionally, the government would crack down and confiscate satellite dishes, but Iranians could usually quickly find replacements, he said. I believe in Voice of America as a news organization and as a voice of America, Ensor said. It was important, and it can be again. From Seth Borenstein, Associated Press. Record heat moves east. After smashing March heat records in 14 states, and the U.S. as a whole, the gigantic heat dome that baked the Southwest is creeping eastward and could end up being one of the most expansive heat waves in American history, meteorologists and weather historians said. And it's not going away for a while, maybe not until the middle of next week as April starts, said meteorologist Greg Galina of the National Weather Service's Weather Prediction Center. Basically, the entire U.S. is going to be hot, Galina said Monday. The area of record temperatures is extremely large. That's the thing that's really bizarre. This heat dome, in which high pressure is acting like a pot lid trapping hot air over a region, will leave Flagstaff, Arizona, with 11 or 12 straight days of temperatures higher than the city's previous March record, said meteorologist Jeff Masters of Yale Climate Connections. Galina said the dome's eastward movement will mean temperatures in the 90s Fahrenheit by Wednesday over the southern and central plains. From one quarter to one third of the 48 continental states will be flirting with records for March, Galina said. The physical area of this heat wave likely dwarfs two other historic heat waves, one in 2012 in the upper Midwest and the Northeast, and another in 2021 in the Pacific Northwest. According to weather historian Chris Burt, author of the book Extreme Weather. It may not be as large as the Dust Bowl heat waves of 1936, but that was a series of heat waves over 2 months during summer, not a single big event like now, Burt said. Both the Dust Bowl and the 2021 heat wave were more intense, with higher temperatures that hurt people more because they fell in June and July, Galina said. Another saving grace for people in this heat wave is that it's not as humid as it would be if the temperatures rose in the summer, Galina said. On Friday, four places in Arizona and California hit 112 degrees, according to the Weather Service. Not only did that smash the record for the hottest March day in the continental United States by 4 degrees, but it was only 1 degree shy of the hottest day recorded in the lower 48 in April. Climatologist and weather historian Maximiliano Herrera, who tracks global weather records, compiled a list of 14 states that have notched their hottest March day on record since this heat dome started. California, Arizona, Nevada, Kansas, New Mexico, Nebraska, Utah, South Dakota, Missouri, Iowa, Colorado, Wyoming, Minnesota, and Idaho. In Mexico, even May records were trashed with March records broken by as much as 14 degrees Fahrenheit, far more than July 1936, March 1907, or June 21, Herrera wrote in an email. The National Center for Environmental Information registered at least 479 weather stations breaking records for March from Wednesday through Saturday based on its network of stations. Herrera, who analyzed a broader set of data, said the true number is likely higher. Another 1,472 daily records, which are easier to break, were shattered at the same time, the center said. What's happening is the jet stream, which moves weather systems from west to east, is pretty much stuck as far westward as the storms dousing Hawaii, where people are experiencing torrential rains and flooding, Masters and Galina said. On Friday, a group of international climate scientists called World Weather Attribution determined that the record heat was virtually impossible and 800 times more likely because of climate change from the burning of coal, oil, and natural gas. The result of those activities added at least 4.7 degrees to the heat, said report co-author Claire Barnes, an Imperial College of London scientist with the group. The heat dome will move on by late next week, Masters said. We just have to give it time. On immigration enforcement, info becomes harder to find. Trump administration lacks consistent data reporting on key policy. From the Associated Press, Rebecca Santana. The Trump administration likes to promote its immigration enforcement agenda through numbers, with ambitious goals to deport 1 million people, report zero releases at the U.S.-Mexico border, and arrest thousands of alleged gang members. For all the boasting, the administration has released less reliable, carefully vetted data than its predecessors on a signature policy. The gap information and a loss of figures from an office that tracked immigration data back to the 1800s left researchers, advocates, lawyers, and journalists without important statistics to hold the Republican administration to account. "They aren't publishing the data," said Mike Howell, who heads the Conservative Oversight Project, an advocacy group pushing for more deportations. Instead, Howell said, the Department of Homeland Security put out numbers and news releases that purport to be statistics with no statistical backup, and the numbers have jumped all over the place. With mass deportations a priority, new restrictions and increased enforcement led to a surge in immigration arrests, detentions, and deportations. But finding the metrics that once measured those changes can be difficult. The Office of Homeland Security Statistics is responsible for publishing figures from Homeland Security agencies, including removals and the nationalities of those deported, to provide a comprehensive picture of immigration trends at the border and inside the United States. In its current form, created under the Biden administration, it also started publishing monthly reports that allowed researchers to track developments almost in real time. But key enforcement metrics on its website haven't been updated since early last year. A note on the page where the monthly reports were says it is delayed while it is under review. It's the most timely data. It's the most reliable data, Austin Coker, a research professor at Syracuse University, who closely follows immigration data trends, said about the monthly reports. It has the most omniscient view of immigration enforcement across the entire agency. And in interactive dashboard launched by the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement in December 23 once let users examine whom the agency was arresting, their nationalities, criminal histories, and removal numbers. Though intended for quarterly updates, the latest data is from January 25. The agency's annual report, typically released in December, hadn't been published as of mid-March. Other agencies also publish data that touches on immigration, and parts of it continue to roll out, such as U.S. Customs and Border Protection statistics, detailing border encounters, or data from the Department of Justice's immigration courts. But experts say other data has slowed. The State Department's most recent visa issuance data is from August. Key statistics from U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services have not been updated since October. We're all a little bit in the dark about exactly how immigration enforcement is operating at a time when it's taking new and unprecedented forms, said Julia Gillott, Associate Director of the U.S. Immigration Policy Program at the Migration Policy Institute. DHS did not respond to detailed questions about why it was no longer releasing specific data. Figures the administration has released are inconsistent and unverifiable. In a January 20th news release, DHS said it deported more than 675,000 people since Trump returned to the White House. A day later, in a second release, the department put the figure at 622,000. In congressional testimony March 4th, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem said the figure was 700,000. But ICE, an agency within DHS, also releases figures on how many people it has removed from the country, part of a large data release mandated by Congress. An Associated Press analysis of the figures put that number at about 400,000 over Trump's first year. Today in history, on this date, in 1894, Jacob S. Coxey began a march from Massillon, Ohio, to Washington, leading an army of as many as 500 unemployed workers to demand help from the federal government following the Panic of 1893 and ensuing depression. In 1947, a coal dust explosion inside the Centralia Coal Company mine in Washington County, Illinois, killed 111 miners. 31 survived. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, Wednesday, March 25th. Please stay tuned.